This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Chapter 37, the beginning and then our wrap-up of the entire Goblet of Fire book, the fourth installment, and our typical questions and just general discussion about our impressions and feelings about book number four in Harry Potter.
Great. Yeah. It's gosh, how long have we been reading this book? It's been a good while.
It's been a year, and by the end of 2022, we'll have finished the whole series.
And I can't remember when we started reading this book, The Goblet of Fire.
It was like early August.
Wow. Okay. That's a long time.
August, yeah.
Okay.
Because we started in like January, February, like the whole series, but the first three are so tiny, and then you have this brick.
Yeah, right. Well, all right. Well, we will talk about our thoughts and feelings, I guess, toward the end, but first we got to get through the beginning, which is a weird word to say, but yeah, weird way to phrase that.
First question, did you put it together when you saw the artwork of chapter 37?
No.
No?
Not at all. I didn't really look that closely. And then, you know, after we learn kind of what the deal is, then I was like, oh, she does have little glasses on. So, and a little effed up, I think. It's a little strange, the whole beetle situation. But anyway, yeah.
And it just kind of shows you that, yeah, we'll get to it just... that people can just be animagus and they don't have to tell anybody if they don't want to.
Yeah, that's kind of, we've had that encountered a couple of times, but a beetle, that's kind of like a really unfortunate, but really appropriate for her. Anyway.
Really appropriate for her. And again, my understanding of the Potter canon is that someone does not choose their animagus form. They all go through the same very rigorous full moon, whatever crap they gotta do, and then they just find out what their animal form is. They don't get to pick.
Gotcha. Wow. Cool.
Anyway, chapter 37, the beginning, and it's been a whole month since the whole ordeal of graveyard crazy cult ritual, Cedric's death.
Yeah, this is kind of a little time jump, because I wrote a note. I'm like, did the time jump? Maybe it didn't, but it kind of did. We don't slog through the end of the semester like we have in previous chapters. So anyway, it's kind of Harry's kind of rehashing what has happened in that time period.
Yeah, and the most painful of which was the meeting with Cedric's parents.
Yeah, which, I mean, of course, it's got to be super hard. And, you know, they take it, Cedric's dad, for all of kind of his bravado, he was obviously upset and rightfully so, but he was very, he didn't blame Harry. He didn't, you know, nothing like that. He was just kind of like, this is a bad situation, and they didn't fault Harry for him. Anything.
Yeah, like for as much as Amos was a bit of a dick in terms of wanting Cedric to one-up Harry And even to the end of, like, beginning of the day of the third task, you know, Cedric's like, ignore him. He's just bitter about the Rita Skeeter article, blah, 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 blah. But then finally we get to this point, and Amos just doesn't care about lashing at Harry or anything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Harry, you know, didn't have to go back and get, or, you know, Harry kind of put himself in more danger by dragging Cedric's body along with him. He didn't have to do that. So I think the Diggorys are just appreciative of the fact that he did that.
Well, and I think to a certain extent, it's, you know, I think there's a parallel that was in the trivia that I had with Amanda and others, the Harry Potter trivia, of there's some connection in the Iliad of, like, the protagonist, you know, risking their life to go retrieve a fallen comrade's body, and that's supposed to be paralleled with Harry and Cedric.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the Diggorys, Harry tries to give them the money, but they're like, no, we don't want it. And we're not really told the exact, like, socioeconomic status of the Diggorys, but I just know from Potter encyclopedic knowledge, because I have nothing better to do with my time, is that a Diggory was once the Minister of Magic, like, way back in, like, the 18th or 17th century. So if not totally pure blood, they're very, like, kind of old family-ish side.
Yeah, so they're, you know, they don't have to, yeah, they're not, like, desperate for that money. They're just kind of like, yeah, you know, and I can understand too, if they're in a comfortable situation, they don't need to, if they don't need it, why would they want it? It's kind of a reminder of the pain and his death.
Oh, yeah. What I wanted to say is it's a good thing that Harry did bring Cedric's body back, not because it's morally, you know, a very, you know, nice gesture, but with the combination of Fudge's denial of the things that have happened and Cedric's body not being there, then I think that might have put the Diggorys in more pain of, you know, someone saying that their son is definitely dead, and then the minister saying, no, he's not back, you know, something else happened to Cedric, you know, that would have been even worse.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree with that as well.
And Harry's just kind of chilling with Ron and Hermione, kind of going through the corridors in a daze. He can take notice of people, like, kind of whispering about them, and he thinks that many of them probably have believed Rita Skeeter about him being mentally unbalanced, and at this point he doesn't really care.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't blame him for not caring. Like, Rita Skeeter, just, who cares about her? And I don't know, am I too far in here? Because they talked to Hagrid.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. And, well, first we got, you know, Mrs. Weasley tried to ask Dumbledore, can we just take Harry immediately to our place and not have him deal with the Dursleys? But no, that's not going to be a thing. He has to go back to the Dursleys.
And then even Harry's kind of like, I guess Dumbledore must have some sort of motivation for that being the case. But, you know, I just kind of feel like Harry's just kind of floating through this bit of this chapter for a while, and he's just like, well, okay, I guess he has his reasons, and then it's kind of, the matter is kind of closed and they move on.
Yep. And then we get to visiting Hagrid, and Hagrid's just like, you all right, Harry? And he's like, sure. And he's like, no, you're not, but you will be.
right. Yeah. Hagrid, I mean, I got to be honest, my quote for the book and our wrap up is from Hagrid, not Dumbledore, which is kind of
shocker.
I know. Yeah. It's so, Dumbledore is such a good, like, always has great quotes, but Hagrid really had some good advice here for his young friend, Harry.
And in his conversation with Hagrid, Hagrid, you know, says something to the effect of knew he was going to come back, just biding his time, whatever. And, you know, it's interesting Fudge's, you know, level of denial, because Hagrid is not an outlier in that sort of scenario. Like, we've gotten tidbits of, you know, what Ron has talked about in the Wizarding World about people being scared. Like, you know, there was a sort of, like, ethos that it wasn't entirely impossible for Voldemort to come back, because, again, there never was any body.
Right.
And for someone who reads as much mystery as I do, if there's no body, then they're not dead.
Right. Yeah. That's like, yeah, there has been several shows. It's like, if you don't see it happen, it happens off screen. Don't trust it.
Yeah. This isn't Greek drama where everything happens off stage.
Right. Right.
Exactly. So Dad just reminded me when Hagrid was mentioning that sort of thing. It's like, Hagrid is not like revolutionary or novel in this idea. A lot of segments of Wizarding Society kind of felt this way, and even possibly Fudge might have been at one point susceptible to thinking this way, but he's just totally blinded by, again, the implications that this basically would be the end of his political career.
Yeah, that's kind of it, not thinking very clearly about what's actually happening, and instead of thinking, I guess, kind of his self, himself, and it's something that I think we all face.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Hagrid says, "I've got a little job over the summer, and Olympe, Madame Maxime, to you, might be joining me."
Oh, so it sounds like, you know, they're obviously back on the, they're okay with each other again, which is good.
Yep. They're on speaking terms, and they're going to be working together. Do you have any idea what they're going to be working on?
Well, my only thought, if I'm going to speculate, would had something to do with, you know, Dumbledore's kind of request of Fudge and dealing with the giants. So probably kind of dealing with that in some capacity. That's going to be my guess. But that also requires Madame Maxime to kind of come to terms with something that she very much kind of did not want to deal with earlier in the book. So I don't know.
I'm not giving that much away, but your assumptions are correct.
Okay. Okay. That's pretty good. I mean,
yeah, it's pretty obvious, because there's really nothing else that Hagrid would be more suited for.
Right. Right.
Yep. And yeah, it's interesting just the notion of how calmly Hagrid is taking Voldemort's return, because, you know, again, Hagrid, we know from Chamber of Secrets, was framed by Voldemort, Tom Riddle, as a teenager. So they're more or less the same age, and Hagrid remembers what Voldemort used to look like and who he used to be, just a normal, quote-unquote, normal level, like, sociopath that was manipulative before he went all crazy snake cult guy.
Well, my God, if Hagrid turns out to be like a freaking villain, I'm going to just burn all these books, because like I can't deal with that. So I really, really, really don't think that's the direction that we're going here. But, you know, that's something that I kind of noticed too. It's like, well, why is he so kind of like, I mean, it's going to happen, whatever. God, there was something else that I was... I don't know. I don't know, you know, I feel like we know Hagrid's kind of demeanor enough now. I don't think he's one to freak out, but he's also one to kind of know what he knows. And he must have, I mean, I also think he kind of wholly has confidence in Dumbledore. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, they finished their little visit to Hagrid, skipping a visit of the last Blasted Scroot.
Yeah.
And instead of the whole, like, you know, Great Hall being decorated with, like, the colors of the house that won, like, the house cup, it's all in black in memory of Cedric. And we get the real Mad-Eye Moody was at the staff table, now his wooden leg and his magical eye back in place. He was extremely twitchy, jumping every time someone spoke to him. I'm just, yeah, again, poor guy. He already had a reputation of being paranoid. Like, what's it gonna be now?
Right, right. You know, and that's the thing. When they were talking about this description of Mad-Eye Moody, I'm like, this is the genuine, like, very skittish, like, he has been through, you know, and I'm not trivializing this in any sort of way, but kind of like the post-traumatic stress disorder person who's very much still, you know, processing it. And that is probably how he actually is. I don't know if he shows up again. I hope so. Kind of, because I would really like to see how he is in actuality.
Yeah, we shall see. And so, yeah, Mad-Eye's there, Maxime is there, and Harry has a good long look at Snape. And, like, again, just kind of thinking about, again, the both this year from the Pensieve and Snape vocalizing it himself about his shady past with the Death Eaters.
Right, yeah. So kind of like what we talked about on last week about the kids kind of finally coming to the realization that everybody knows that Snape was once a Death Eater and that everybody's kind of okay with that. And it's just, I can imagine being a kid and kind of, you know, this has got to be kind of a little bit of a mind mess around.
Yeah, like in many ways, like the sort of prejudice and stuff that Snape's dealing with or has dealt with is not wholly unlike the prejudice of Remus being a werewolf and the incredulity that Dumbledore would hire him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Snape definitely has, I'm sure there's some irritation that he's at the school as well.
Mm-hmm.
We just haven't talked about it as in depth, like in the book so far.
Yep. And then we've got, you know, Dumbledore and his, you know, little speech about Cedric Diggory saying that he was murdered by Voldemort, and we only get one mention of Cho. Harry caught a glimpse of Cho through the crowd because, you know, Cho, Harry had more or less kind of given up on Cho because she started basically dating Cedric after the Yule Ball.
Right. Yeah.
And so the only mention of her is there were tears pouring silently down her face.
Poor Cho.
Yeah. Poor Cho. And Cedric was a person who exemplified many of the qualities that distinguish Hufflepuff House. He was a good and loyal friend, a hard worker. He valued fair play. His death has affected you all, whether you knew him well or not. I think you have the right, therefore, to know exactly how it came about. And definitely, I didn't even think about this in my notes, but just reading that now made me think of, again, when I was 2013, the shit hit the fan with the military ousting President Morsi, and we had to be evacuated. And technically, we left, you know, before the embassy or anyone else told us you need to leave, because one of the members of our group, like, I did not know him well, like, we had just 7 days before had been, you know, riding camels side by side, just shooting the breeze at the pyramids, and then next day, and then exactly 7 days later, this colleague of mine that I'd been talking to got caught up in a protest and got stabbed and died.
Oh my gosh, that's
so
awful.
Yeah. So like, whether you know someone well or not, like, you know, just those weird situations where you're confronted with like death like that and how quickly it can take someone. And the guy was even younger than me, and I was like, what, 21 at the time?
Yeah, I remember being in elementary school and having students die. Not a bunch of students. That makes it sound like very, like there was some horrible accident. There wasn't, but it wouldn't be, it fortunately for me, it wasn't somebody I was particularly close with, but still it definitely reverberates across, you know, but the people that you're around.
I remember my dad being especially impacted because it wasn't a close friend of my sister, but one of the students in her graduation year, you know, died, you know, in a car crash on graduation night, not because she had been drinking or doing anything stupid, but another guy who had been drinking, you know, hit her. And of course he lived and she died.
Of course. Yeah. Ugh. I don't have a lot of tolerance for drinking.
Again, fuck those guys and don't even think of doing crazy shit on New Year's Eve.
Yeah. It's the reason I stay home.
reason, like, I'm canceling my, New Year's Eve party that I was going to do just because I live so far out of town, and for just the nature of most people want to drink on, you know, New Year's Eve and don't want to drive all the way back into town for my place. And I'm just like, you know what, screw it. Like, just New Year's Eve is not a good place is not a thing for my house. I can do other holidays.
I think that is a safe choice. There's too many bad decisions made that night.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, Dumbledore saying, you know, the Ministry of Magic does not wish me to tell you this. It is possible that some of your parents will be horrified that I have done so, either because they will not believe it or because they think I should not tell you at all, so young as you are. And I like this. It is my belief, however, that the truth is greatly preferable to lies, and that any attempt to pretend that Cedric died as a result of an accident or some sort of blunder of his own is an insult to his memory. Because that's an interesting thing to think about, like, you know, it would be much easier if Harry did not bring Cedric's body back, and it would be much more easy for the Ministry to deny. So what is the Ministry of Magic and Fudge, you know, officially saying in terms of how Cedric died if they're not going to accept Dumbledore in Harry's version.
Right. I don't know. I don't know. But if it's going to portray Cedric in a poor light, I mean, you know, the kid's dead. So, but still, it's like, well, you know, he was doing whatever. It's, there's still some level of blame, and they can kind of be like, oh, well, kind of, you know, dismiss responsibility. I kind of took away from this, you know, I have two nieces, or I have three nieces. Oh my gosh, I don't know how many. I'm a honorary niece to several of my friends' kids. And just kind of seeing the different ways people parent their kids when tragedy happens. Like my, you know, I have had the unfortunate situation, poor Amy and I share this, that we have lost beloved pets this year. And my brother and sister-in-law told my niece that, you know, they died. They didn't tell them that, you know, Jess's kitty went off to the farm. It was like, no, she lost her pet. Kitties die, you know, it's, and how in the long term, it will probably serve them better to know that. So, I thought this was really, I guess maybe just from the time I'm reading it, thought it was a very important, like, message that, no, we have to say, we have to be honest about these things. So later on in life, it's not confused. And with Cedric, it's like, he didn't do anything wrong. This horrible person came back to life and killed him. There you go. Whatever the stork didn't bring you, you know, let's just be honest. So I appreciated Dumbledore's decision.
And then Draco Malfoy's being an asshole and is just not even feigning to like offer any sort of respect, you know, but.
They're just kind of sitting there just being like, well, Dork Lord's back. So like all is well in our world. Who cares about this kid? It's just, you know. What a collateral damage, I guess.
Yep. And then Dumbledore gives a toast to Harry, who acknowledges he risked his own life to return Cedric's body to Hogwarts, which,
right.
Again, I don't, yeah, you know, for all this shit that, you know, Harry has to do because he's Harry Potter, like, you know, that, you know, is especially, you know, a very noble act.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Good for Harry.
Yep. And then, you know, Dumbledore going on about unity and we need to stick together because Voldemort will easily try to divide us and thus we're more susceptible to enmity, blah, blah, blah. And everyone who is a guest here is always welcome at Hogwarts. And that is, yeah, he ends with, remember Cedric, remember if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy, remember what happened to a boy who is good and kind and brave. Because he strayed across the path of Lord Voldemort. Remember Cedric Diggory.
I'm glad we kind of got like some, you know, a time to mourn or like the openness to mourn Cedric for, because for a while there, I was like, are we just going to steamroll past this? And I'm glad Harry made sure to make note of this and remember Cedric in this section of the book.
Yeah, because I'm just, again, I'm not one for parents who are trying to, you know, you can tell them, you know, serious things and you can code it in kid-like language. I once watched a Dr. Phil episode where there was basically a kind of family feud going on between, you know, this woman was, you know, the victim of like domestic abuse and her ex-husband, father of her child, tried to shoot her and he's now in jail. And so she's currently having a, like, basically a fight with her, you know, previous mother and sister-in-law, the mother and sister of this guy who is in jail. And, you know, them kind of, you know, not always wanting to acknowledge that he is definitely the guilty party in this situation. And so he, you know, what she would say in kid-friendly terms is like with, you know, her child, son or daughter, saying like, your father's in big boy timeout, like to, you know, to show that. And, you know, Dr. Phil was, you know, ripping out the mother-in-law and sister-in-law because, you know, this has been a therapist approved like strategy and you're not going along with it because you want to save your you know, your brother son's reputation and you're conflicting with a therapy approved way of how to, you know, show, you know, how to convey this to a child of why their father is not there.
Right. Oh, wow. That's an interesting way to phrase it. So I like that.
Yeah. But anyway, you can do it. You can do a lot of things in age-appropriate language, which is why there's no reason why sex education should be the dumpster fire that it is. But
I agree about that a lot. Yes.
Anyway, I digress. So, you know, Harry's trunk is packed, and basically biggest scene is saying goodbye to everyone at King's Cross. Not King's Cross, that's where they're going to at the station at Hogsmeade. And Fleur is, you know, saying goodbye to Harry, and she's like, I hope to see you soon. I'm hoping to get a job here in England. I want to improve my English.
Nice.
And then Crumb comes around and wants to talk to Hermione, of course.
Of course. And then Ron has the reaction he has always wanted to have to Crumb, but he was too, like, self-conscious or, like, prideful to do so.
And wrapped up in his own twisted Hermione complicating thing.
Yes. And yes.
But he finally cannot resist the urge. Can I have your autograph?
You know what? And Crumb gives it to him, thank goodness. And, you know, I'm sure, looking back, Ron will be like, I should have just done that sooner.
Yep. And Crumb is just like, you know, Hermione's like, can they sail that ship all by themselves? And Crumb's just like, Karkaroff didn't do shit.
Yeah. Yeah. He's kind of like, we'll be fine. Oh my gosh.
Yep. And then what do we got? So Crumb takes his part, and then we kind of segue into them in their compartment, you know, on the train with Pigwidgeon and Crookshanks. And we get a lot of the sort of clothes tying up the loose ends of all the subplots of this,
yeah,
of this book, as is wont to happen with these books, because all of the subplots have to be tied up on the train.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, here's the place to do it. And specifically with the Rita Skeeter thing, which is, I don't know how I feel about all this.
My question is, how do you feel about that? Again, this is a time jump. And basically, so if you look back of Hermione making that noise in the hospital wing, so she's been keeping Rita Skeeter, a grown woman, captive for a month.
Yeah, that's the part that really disturbs me. I mean, like, you know, I know, I mean, I'm an animal rightsy person anyway. This broke my brain a little bit. It's kind of like, I don't know how
this is definitely sort of the beginnings of kind of of showing Hermione can be hardcore when, uh-huh, quote unquote necessary, and this will show up in other ways. And there's one very specific thing she does in book 5 that totally divides the fandom, which again both this and that I'm less concerned about, because I'm a Machiavellian Hufflepuff, apparently.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because with Rita, again, I just have so little sympathy for Rita of, you know, she chooses to use an illegal means to get dirt on people. Of course, they're going to come after you the minute you expose yourself like that. So, I mean,
yeah.
It's my belief in karma, and it's not even believing in karma as this, like, cosmic force that, you know, a higher god, like, thinks you deserve bad or you deserve good. Karma can purely be the sense of you already conduct your life so, like, recklessly and so badly, you are going to get yourself in trouble eventually. You know, it's not even a cosmic, you know, deified force doing that. You are going to do that because you are going to screw up and slip one day.
Yeah, I understand kind of the reason. Well, let me back up. The very appropriate, you know, form that Rita takes to get the information she does, you know, is bugging. And then it's like, she's like a literal bug. Like, that's pretty, pretty crazy. Hermione's like, this is just me being the way I am and the way I perceive things. I was kind of like, it was a weird decision, and I'm like I said, it kind of broke my brain, and I was kind of like, I mean, I'm not no fan of Rita Skeeter by any means. Like, she's kind of the worst, and Hermione is being a little vindictive here, I think. I don't know.
Hermione hasn't told the boys this because, again, with Cedric's death and everything, like, she just hasn't felt that any of it has been appropriate. But what she could have done is she could have, captured Rita first, like, gone off to the edge of the grounds, release her and be like, don't you, you know, and still continue to blackmail her of, you know, don't you dare write anything or I will tell the authorities that you're an unregistered animagus. She could have, like, done that, but she chose specifically to keep her encapsulated in a jar for a good, like, 30 days and is going to release her in London.
Yeah, well, you know, thankfully she said that part. Like, at least, I mean, I was kind of like, this is kind of effed up. If she would have kept her in the jar, I would have been like, I don't like that at all. But if she's going to release her in London, and she's, I guess, in this beetle form for the rest of her life,
she's in beetle form the rest of her life. It's Hermione's put a specific charm that the glass can't break, so she can't just smash the glass by transforming into a human. So once Hermione releases her, she can turn back into a human.
Okay.
It's not like she's stuck in her, like, animal form. That is the Maledictus, the Nagini Fantastic Beast crap, which hasn't been fully explained. But no, this is not with Rita Skeeter.
Okay, good. Well, then this is a little less dark than I thought it was, because I was like, I think I just decided in my brain that's what was happening. I mean, then what? I mean, it still is kind of a little much to keep somebody in a glass jar for 30 days. But I mean, I don't know. Hermione was pretty upset, and Rita did a lot of damage.
And it's not even just petty, like, tabloids. Like, her article of Harry being unhinged as having very substantial, tangible consequences.
Yeah. I'm going to just say, like, to be determined how I feel about this.
Yeah. You and Amanda make me feel like I'm so heartless, but.
No,
I'm a Machiavellian Hufflepuff. So that was a subplot reveal. And then another subplot reveal is, what is it? Well, first Malfoy comes in and is just being all smug, whatever, and trying to throw shade at Cedric, and, you know, basically all of them curse
right
Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle, like, simultaneously, and then they just, like, shove their bodies into another compartment, and just, like, Fred or George made a point to specifically not to, like, avoid, but to tread on Malfoy.
That, and here's the effed up thing, I'm kind of like, I'm fine with that, like, when it comes to people, I don't care. I don't know. Yeah, this was fine. I did like the kind of, like, all the jinxes or whatever coming together at one.
Get the Fred and George, who were they blackmailing? So you were right. You did guess it, that Ludo was a gambler.
Ludo, the gambling man. And this was quite the reveal of the subplot. And then it kind of tied in Harry finally got to give his money to somebody, which was good. But yes, the Ludo Bagman kind of debacle, I guess. I guess this was my question about the leprechaun gold, because basically he gave Fred and George leprechaun gold, right? So it disappeared.
Yeah.
Why didn't they know that? Is that just something that wasn't known by Fred and George, or is it?
Like, it vanished the next day, and they knew that, so, like, they were just keeping it to themselves, like, trying to say, just politely say, oh, I think you made a mistake, and they ignored their letters, and then they started to go down, like, the blackmailing route, and that's when, you know, the Golden Trio and others started to notice. So it's like, you know, Ron, Harry, and Hermione didn't know about leprechaun gold managing, you know, because they're fourth years, but Fred and George, like, knew immediately.
When they received it, they were like, oh,
Not when they received it, but the next day when they realized it vanished.
Yeah, okay. Like, that's the thing that I guess I'm a little confused on. So the leprechaun gold must look enough like just regular.
Yeah,
it,
like,
doesn't look different?
No, it does. From what we know, it doesn't look different.
Okay.
The way you tell it's leprechaun gold is that the place where you put it, it's now gone.
Right. Okay. Because I was thinking, like, if there's a distinction, like, if it's like a different coin, like, you just showed me some money from another country before we got on the mic. then it would be,
which is absolutely worthless now. I wish I had galleons.
Well, there we go. So I didn't know if it was just, if it was just something because of their status, they just hadn't had any familiarity and yet, so they didn't know what it looked like, or if it was just like, oh, it looks like real money. And then it's just all of a sudden it's gone. So, okay. Glad to know that. And yeah, so Ludo, former Quidditch player, right? Like that, he's mm-hmm. that who with a gambling problem and tried to screw over some kids, but yeah, pretty weird. But
yeah, and I think the thing that led you to like your gambling thing was again just so much of his like sort of subplot stuff was with goblins. Like there were goblins accosting him in the forest, and you know, in terms of general like murder mysteries, I love Ludo Bagman as a red herring because he's such a good one, because he's this figure who is like seemingly happy that Harry's name is in the Goblet of Fire. So that kind of puts, he's the only one who isn't really pissed off about this. Maybe it was him. Maybe he, and there was the trial and the pensive of maybe right. he inadvertently passed information to people he shouldn't have, but he was just being a moron.
Yeah. Yeah. This character, man, yeah, we'll talk about it in a while, but yep.
And so, yeah, that was all their savings. And then finally, Harry pulls them aside and is just like, you take the money, you know, you open your joke shop.
Right, which is pretty cool. And, you know, we know, gosh, Draco reminds us any chance he can get that the Weasleys don't have a lot of money. So this is pretty cool. And they didn't refuse. Well, they kind of tried to refuse, and Harry's like, look, take it, I'll put a hex on, you know, what does he say, or I'll hex you, I know some good ones, just do me a favor and buy Ron some different dress robes. And then they kind of move on. So
yep. And then, you know, they arrive at King's Cross and shitty Uncle Vernon is there to pick them up.
Yeah. And there's kind of like some speculation that Dumbledore might let Harry, you know, he might be at the Weasleys later this summer. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. And thus concludes Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Wow. That was a journey. And I'm glad I can pick up the new book. That's well, new to me book. Yeah.
Yes. So let us start with Gothic Geek Out.
Well, you know, this one wasn't, I didn't remember anything super gothic, but I was just thinking the bit of mourning for Cedric and kind of the traditional kind of black and just the approach there and the kind of honesty with the darkness of his death. I don't know if death and darkness are always, you know.
That's the subject of another famous Dumbledore quote in book 6. It is the unknown we fear when we look upon death and darkness, nothing more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that. I'll have to sit with that quote for a little bit. But that was kind of, you know, Cedric died in a really tragic way. Death doesn't always have to be like that. Death can be a relief. So that was kind of, to me, a little gothic. Usually in a gothic story, death is kind of it's not somebody who's been suffering for like 10 years finally having the sweet release of death. It's it's a tragedy. So that's all I could come up with. There wasn't a lot for me.
I was kind of the same thing. Just, well, not, I don't mean this in like a, you know, frivolous way, just, but I, for lack of a better word, the pageantry around like Cedric's death in regards to this like sort of memorial service that Dumbledore has in the great hall with the like black fabric and everything.
Yeah we're on the same page.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, now we can do Tarot of the Day. Get ready. Ooh. For it.
Beautiful.
That'll hopefully be the new sound effect for Tarot of the Day, because I actually have a legit Tibetan singing bowl now.
Awesome. I like it.
So the tarot card I pulled up is the King of Wands.
Okay.
And just immediately just thinking about the fact that I pulled a wand card when a lot of like the means of Harry's escape was the priori incantatum, you know, wand magic stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
So let's see. King of Wands represents pure fire energy in its masculine form. Unlike other wand court cards, the king is not so interested in creation and creativity or in dreaming of ideas and implementing them himself. Instead, he is more inclined to take an idea and then enlist others to help him actualize it. Thus, when the King of Wands appears in a tarot reading, it is a sign that you are stepping into the role of a visionary leader ready to direct your people towards a common goal. So, when I think of that, I immediately think of Dumbledore being a King of Wand like figure in trying to rally people to be like, you know, we need to stand united against this threat. You know, we need to maintain our relations with our foreign allies, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, Dumbledore is very much being that guy right now.
Yeah, I just thought of kind of like very Gryffindor energy here with that card and kind of the fire and just this is very Gryffindor traits, I thought, after you read that.
Yep. And also Dumbledore doing this in the sense enlisting others because he literally has said, Hagrid, go do this.
Yeah. Yeah. He kind of was like, here's what needs to be done at the end of that chapter and gave everybody a task, which they didn't question. Well, with the exception of Cornelius Fudge, but we're talking about like the legit players in my mind.
Yeah. The King of Wands reminds you to lead your life with intent, vision, and long-term view. You have a grand idea of what is truly possible, and you will stop at nothing to see it through. Unlike the knight who can be a little impulsive with his actions, you have the maturity to see your vision through right to the end and beyond. You know, in some ways that makes me think of just like the sort of personality of Cedric, because Cedric was substantially one of the most mature students that we've come across, and we don't, beyond Fred and George, there aren't a great deal of like secondary characters that are like older than Harry that Harry has substantial contact with, and of course he had substantial contact with Cedric via the Triwizard Tournament, so we don't get like the others are like, you know, most of what we get is, you know, the older members of the Slytherin Quidditch team, and they're hopeless.
Right. Yeah. 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 Cedric is a good one to apply that to. Like, he's not a Gryffindor, but it does definitely apply.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Alrighty then. Yeah. I have no other thoughts for King of Wands. And then the card I picked for of my Black Moon astrology cards, it was not a planet this time. It was a zodiac sign. And it is Scorpio.
I like Scorpio. Scorpio is my rising sign. I'm down with the Scorpio.
Scorpio is also my rising sign, but I have just as you have a conflicted relationship with Capricorns, like Scorpio is my opposite, just as Capricorns is your opposite. So there is that sort of, you know, rivalry, you know, direct opposite energy going on with me and Scorpio. And also I have the added context that all of my major ex-boyfriends were Scorpios.
I which that's so funny. And how many Scorpios? I dated a lot of Tauruses, so I don't know.
So yeah, so Scorpio gets the bad rep of being like the like super mysterious, like diabolical, the super sexual one, like all sorts of stuff. So let's see. Scorpios have a bad reputation for ruthless behavior, which is not deserved. Like the other water signs, Scorpio is emotional, but not in the sympathetic ways of Cancer or Pisces. When Scorpios enter a room, they don't have to say a word for the crowd to know they can feel their energy. Their depth and their ability to understand others, all the while not revealing much about themselves, is profound. Scorpios inspire you to tell them your darkest secrets while revealing none of their own. So, you know what? I feel like Scorpios suffer from the same bad rep as Slytherins, is that a lot of their qualities are innately neutral.
Yeah.
And yeah. Naturally, neutral things can be good for benign or malevolent reasons.
Yeah.
Although, again, for all the crap of Scorpios being evil, like, you know, if a Cancer is not a good person, like, That's I would take the Scorpio. I would take a complicated, not pure devil Scorpio over a nasty Cancer.
I'm both. I'm like pure water sign, and I mean, let me just say, I know the good sides and the dark sides, and I feel like I've embodied both of them sometimes. Not that I'm proud of it, but you know.
Yeah, if the Scorpio card comes up, then you are being tested. You may feel isolated and on your own without much sympathy or help from others. What does that sound like?
I don't know.
Sounds like a little Harry James Potter with yeah. everyone thinking he's a nut job and whispering behind their hands.
Exactly.
Matters involving inheritance and money may figure in.
Well, geez, that's like two on the nose for this chapter, isn't it? That's funny.
Yes, of Harry trying to get rid of this blood money.
Right, yes, the blood money, yes.
Be careful when it comes to finances and areas such as taxes, property, and shared assets. You could have resounding success or tremendous losses currently, but the message is to take your chance and stick with your decision no matter what. You have the ability now to make it work, which I apply to Fred and George as being the recipient of said money.
Yeah.
Like they're in a position where it's not like they lost or did anything to quote unquote earn this money. It was just given to them so they can, you know, more securely, you know, stand behind their decisions and spending it, you know, and be like, oh, if it fails, you know, it's not like we lost anything because Harry gave it to us.
Right. Right. Yeah. Let's just hope they invest it and do something good because they could be really successful. I think they do, but I don't know. I also know a big spoiler about those two, so I, yeah.
Oh, you do? No, that makes me sad. Don't say it.
I know. All you Harry Potter fans that I've known for so many years, I know too much. I don't know when it happens or how it happens. That's usually my story. I just know that it happens. So.
Yep, and the last exercise for this specific chapter is fan fiction time. So, mine was, what if Hermione had agreed to go to Bulgaria with Victor?
I think that would be great for her. I mean, like, good, you know, I don't know how well traveled in like, the muggle world she is, and I don't know how well traveled she is in the human world. I would assume she does okay. Her parents are both dentists in the U.S. That's like,
the
you
UK.
Know. Yeah, well, in the U.S., that's a decent salary. I don't know what it's like in the U.K., if that's but, you know, I know my dentist does all right, and he travels a lot. So I think it would be good for her. I mean,
I'm just imagining a scenario where Harry and Ron are like, where's your stuff? Hermione's like, oh, I'm not going on the train. I'm going on the ship.
Oh, my God. Ron would lose his mind, wouldn't he? Yeah. I don't know. I think it would be good for her. But
again, not that it's directly stated anywhere. I am of the personal opinion that, you know, there are two interpretations of Hermione and Victor's relationship. One is that they really don't have all that much in common and that she sort of got with him, not to be mean or manipulative or anything, but he's the only guy who is giving her attention because she has this reputation of being a know-it-all. No one else will give her the time of day at Hogwarts in a romantic sense.
Okay.
So that's one interpretation of how this buff Quidditch player is with the brainy girl. And then there's my version of headcanon where I secretly think that Victor Crumb is actually very smart and doing some serious alchemy shit in his spare time, and Hermione digs that.
I think that would be, I mean, I don't like the dumb jock trope when it shows up. I think it's boring and played out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be fun. I mean, I think that there is some, you know, him hanging out in the library. If you want to think it's just because he's like crushing on Hermione, that's sure. That's one opinion. But I kind of like that he's actually there because he wants to be.
Yeah.
So Hermione aside.
Yeah. Did you have a fanfic what if?
I did. And it's something I think I harped on a little bit when we were having our conversation is like, what if Dumbledore had just treated the students as like unable to handle the reality of what happened to Cedric. And he kind of just didn't talk about it. Like, I know several situations that have come up in the workplace or just, you know, in school where it's just like, and we just move past that like nothing happened. My assumption is probably the students would, as happens at, you know, workplaces or schools, when there's that big thing that nobody talks about, it kind of usually bubbles up and causes more trouble later. So that would be very out of character for Dumbledore, but I guess also with Dumbledore, we would have to assume that there was a reason that he wasn't talking about it. So
yeah, I'm thinking about it. And again, one scenario would be not so much that he doesn't trust the kids to handle it, but I could imagine maybe Dumbledore making the decision that, okay, in light of Fudge being as difficult as he's being, to for me to say anything is just going to confuse them, is going to not not serve a really productive purpose if, like, if the whole wizarding government is not going to, like, help them, like in some ways that might just be making the situation worse, which I can understand because it reminds me of, again, the whole situation with my, you know, with my husband's ex-girlfriend, of, you know, her trying to demand people, you know, take sides and trying to portray her personal vendetta as a form of anti-domestic abuse activism. And in that scenario, it was better for both my husband and myself to not say anything, to not try to fight for, again, for the popularity.
Yeah.
So circumstances are different. Stakes are higher with, you know, Dumbledore, because this is the fate of the crazy terrorist is back, you know, but, you know, I could understand someone taking that position.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He would have his reasons. And I feel like then they would be revealed in like book 7, which apparently was where everything I want to know is going to happen.
No, it all gets revealed in book 9. Where else is it supposed to be revealed?
Or book 6 or book 7. I mean, it's just like, it's all at the end. It's like, oh, okay. Well,
there's a good chunk of things that Harry, the writer, gives us some things at the end of book 5 that keep us going until the very end. But
well, good. Good, because otherwise I'd be like, what is going on? That's the only thing I could kind of come up with.
Yeah. Alrighty then, and then we can move up into our wrap-up questions. Okay, so let's see, where are my notes? I just copy-pasted all of the old questions with my answers. So, question number 1, Jess. What was your favorite chapter in Goblet of Fire and why?
And I'm going to do the thing, because I spend my life on Zoom meetings, I'm looking at my other screen because that's where my notes are. My favorite chapter was The Unforgivable Curses. And it was because I liked kind of the macabre aspects of this chapter, and that how we kind of are finally building more gothic horror into it. But like the level of gothic horror I'm gonna tap out in is like oh gosh, I forgot the title of the chapter, but anyway, was chapter 32, Flesh, Blood and Bone. But my favorite chapter was The Unforgivable Curses. I think that was the point where I kind of, you know, became more interested. And even though, like, you know, Mad-Eye Moody catfished me, I still liked that. So it was good.
Okay. My favorite chapter was, I forget the number, it was like 29 or something. The Hungarian Horntail chapter, which is not the first task of Harry fighting the dragon. It's the one where Harry goes into the forest following Hagrid and sees it. So I like that chapter because, of course, it has dragons.
Right, yes.
Which are awesome. Yes. And then it has, you know, Sirius coming into the fireplace, like, you know, setting, like, the tone of, you know, pieces of the plot and everything and things Harry has to watch out for. So both of those really good. And then the icing on the cake, the cherry and the cherry on top, is the very short interaction between Harry and Ron in that chapter, where Harry throws the, you know, badge at his face. It's like, good, you'll have a scar now. That's what you want, isn't it? Which, again, something that was, again, even if the Goblet of Fire shit hadn't happened, like, this sort of jealous dynamic would have bubbled to the surface at some point or another in Harry and Ron's friendship, and they needed to duke it out. So
yeah.
So I just felt like that chapter covered, you know, pure fantasy bells and whistles with elements. It covered a lot of, you know, plot points with Sirius, and it covered a lot of, you know, really important, like, relational, you know, people like to, you know, trivialize fantasy as just, again, those, the spectacle of the magic, but no, it's like about people. And the mark of a good fantasy novel is that even though they're in circumstances and situations that you'll never be in, you can still empathize with the decisions they make and how they interact with people.
Right, exactly. That's great.
So yeah, that was my favorite chapter. So, question number two, what was your least favorite chapter and why?
I was reading what I wrote, and I'm like, what did I write? I think, so it's been a little while, but I think it was the chapter, I think it was chapter two, the scar. I usually I don't like the first chapter because it's just like, this is what happened and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we know, we've read these books, like, let's stop. This time, the first chapter, which usually would be like the recap, was replaced with the Riddle House, which I liked. Like, that was a very interesting chapter. I don't know if that was the exact title, just so forgive
me. Chapter one was, Riddle House, and then chapter two was the scar. So that was okay. Your least favorite?
The scar was my least favorite, because I just kind of was like, I mean, we know that Harry had the dream, which was just a recap of the previous chapter, but like in his kind of whatever. And then it was just kind of, you know, some explanation.
Like, it was a step up from not being the general recap, because by then Harry the writer is like, what the hell are you doing picking up book four, man?
Yes.
You know, so it was a step up from the typical, but yeah, the whole chapter was just the processing of the Riddle House dream.
Right, which I was, so that was kind of, I, after kind of flipping through the book again, and like, we've spent like a good amount of time going through these chapters, that was the one that I kind of was like, I don't think I remember that one, and being kind of taken away with that. So that was mine.
Yeah. My least favorite chapter was, again, I forget the numbers. Why didn't I write the numbers down? But Rita Skeeter's Scoop.
Oh, okay. Why was that?
Again, not necessarily in terms of like plot or like pacing or anything of that nature, just the pure, like, pure amorality of Rita Skeeter going after Hagrid. Because again, Hagrid is on the fringes of society. Like, he, like, very much in the spirit of pick on someone your own size. She's going after Hagrid, who is marginalized, and children, you know?
Yeah.
So, and just the fact that that completely breaks Hagrid down, and yeah. I just really hated that for Hagrid.
I think that's a legit reason. I was surprised
by my, you know, choosing that chapter, because again, I'm not the biggest Hagrid fan, because I tend to hold him a little more accountable for how he's not always a responsible adult with the kids, but even that, I'm just like, no, that's not nice. Question number three. Who is your favorite character outside of the Golden Trio?
Well, I struggled with answering this one, and I think you'll understand why. Because I thought I really liked Mad-Eye Moody. And I said, since you all are understanding, I'm reading these and I don't know what's going on. So I'm like recovering from what I just read. And now I'm reading this, now we're wrapping this up. So, and then I'm like, so did I actually like Barty Crouch Jr.? Like, I don't know. But so I did like that kind of character. I liked who he was supposed to be, right? Yeah. So, but if I had to like just, you know, Barty Crouch Jr., not a fan of him, but if I had to eliminate the kind of complexity of that, I would go with Sirius Black, because like, he's just great whenever he shows up. So.
Yeah, of course. Alrighty then. My favorite character outside of the Golden Trio, it was tied between Victor Krum and Cedric Diggory.
Oh, okay. Those are two good ones.
Yeah, because just Cedric, again, we don't get a lot of Hufflepuff secondary characters, you know? Yeah. Because, you know, it's all about the sort of dichotomy between Gryffindor and Slytherin. You know, in the later books, we will get more Ravenclaw with Luna Lovegood and other, you know, and others as well. But, you know, we just don't get a lot of Hufflepuffs. And so I don't think a Hufflepuff will ever feature as prominently in the books again. At least not a Hufflepuff still in school. There are other Hufflepuffs, adults, who we meet later. But, yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Yeah, so I liked Cedric being the upstanding Hufflepuff that we need, because I think for a really long time in the fandom, you know, Hufflepuff got the bad rap and kids were disappointed when they were sorted into Hufflepuff. But then, you know, as decades have passed, as a decade or so has passed, like, the fandom has come to an equilibrium where they see the value in Hufflepuff, and again, the neutrality and benign qualities of Slytherin.
That I remember that, you know, just from my exposure to Harry Potter, people didn't want to be a Hufflepuff. And I remember being like taking a quiz and getting that. And I was like, am I supposed to be upset about this? And then I saw like Fantastic Beasts or whatever. And I was like, oh, I don't mind this.
He is a Hufflepuff, isn't he? But I feel like I'm proud of myself of, not that I interacted a great deal with the fandoms, like, you know, I didn't go to LeagueCon or any of those things. Like, my extension of Harry Potter fandom was reading Harry Potter fanfics by myself on my phone in bed.
Okay, all right.
So for me, yeah, like, when I did the test pretty early, I'm proud of myself that I'm just like, awesome, Hufflepuff, because again, as we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs, as much as I love being wise and being, you know, you look behind me, there are like 300 books on my shelf. As much as I love learning and stuff, I do prefer being good over being smart.
I can't not do the right thing. So that's just inherently Hufflepuff.
Yeah. And then on the other side, just Victor Krum again, for I really like that chip of Hermione and Victor. I like to think in my headcanon of him like defying, you know, dumb jock stereotypes, even though he doesn't always like, you know, display it. And he is a sort of brooding Rochester type. And Slavic, like a combination of brooding Rochester and Dracula.
Oh, man, now I just liked Victor Krum a whole lot more. Y'all know how I feel about Dracula.
Yeah, so, you know, I liked his character in that way. And I just love him even more with Kevin and their podcast, the way he does Krum's voice as a Slavic cookie monster.
Yes, that's pretty great. That's pretty great.
Anyway, so... did you tell me your favorite characters, or I went through on a whole tangent? Yeah.
No. Yeah, I did.
Okay. Yes. So then we move on to question number 4. Who is your least favorite character outside of the Golden Trio?
You know, I think this book, if I was going to talk about like what challenged me as far as a reader, is I just don't particularly care for like the Ministry of Magic politics kind of thing. So Cornelius Fudge was just like, I just, some of those scenes and whatever, while they were very important to the story, I just kind of was like, no. So that just wasn't my bag. It was my favorite character. And some of that, Barty Crouch Senior, I don't know, that just didn't hit for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My least favorite character was Rita Skeeter.
That's a good one.
Yeah, which I don't remember in previous rereadings despising her this much. But again, I talk about my husband's ex-girlfriend too much on this show, but that just was for a good 3 years of traumatizing my life. Like, I will never get past it, and so many elements of that situation come up in literature. And so for me, especially because in that context, and again, as I mentioned before, of her trying to disguise bullying and her personal vendetta as a forms of activism, she was at a point where she was writing articles like about her quote unquote experience, you know, with my, you know, with my husband, and, you know, totally, you know, fabricating things or just, you know, or embellishing things. And again, giving half truths and all sorts of things. And so I just was very much triggered by Rita Skeeter in this reading because of, with my husband's ex, her blogging and stuff. And just, and as a writer, you know, I think of writing and books as like such benevolent, you know, things, you know, in the world. And so the fact that you're using your writing for something bad,
right,
yeah, for propaganda, or like, again, which is why, you know, the interesting dynamics of why I love, you know, Atonement so much.
Oh yeah.
The idea of writing and imagination, like getting someone totally screwed over. So just that sort of figure of someone using their writing talent for evil. And again, because so many times I ask myself, like, why didn't Rita Skeeter just become a novelist? If she wanted to be like sensational, she would have been good at it. Like, and she didn't need to hurt anybody.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I can understand now, like, how that she is not, you don't like her. I also, when I told my niece over the holidays what book I was reading, she was like, ew, Rita Skeeter. I was like, okay. But it definitely, from your perspective, like, makes complete sense.
Yeah. And then, but writing can be used to defend yourself as well, because when I finally got sick of it after 2 years, I started writing articles on my blog. It doesn't exist anymore. I took them down. But I started writing articles about certain things that she had done and how, what I was dealing with. And a lot of, and those articles of hers started to trickle away because she couldn't deal with someone like balancing it and, you know, giving the other perspective.
Wow. Jeez. Ugh.
Anyway. So I digress. So that is why I really did not like Rita Skeeter, which many experiences with that trauma and whatever that I've already thought about in Harry Potter, but specifically the figure of Rita Skeeter as a sort of malevolent writer. I hadn't really thought of it that way before.
Yeah. Interesting. I like it.
Anyway, so it says, well, the question is framed, what is your least favorite character outside the Golden Trio? But just an honorary mention, this was not a good book for Ron.
It wasn't a good book for Ron. Not at all. No, it did not portray him in a favorable light. And then toward the end, he didn't really have a lot to like redeem himself, really. He didn't do anything to really redeem himself.
No, not really. Because again, it was double whammy. It wasn't even just, oh, having like one conflict with Hermione or one conflict with Harry. He gets both conflicts with Harry and Hermione, because first it's with Harry because he can't deal with the jealousy of wanting to be Harry, and then the jealousy of Hermione being with another famous wizard.
Right. Yeah.
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 Question number 5. What was your favorite magical item that appeared in this book?
I don't think I talked about it enough, but it was obviously the pensive, because like, what did I said? I said, I'd appreciate one of those, as my memory tends to get worse with age and just trauma blocking out some memories. So, well, I'm not that I want the memories back that the trauma blocked, but you know what I mean? Like it kind of screws with your memory a little bit. So, yeah, I think that was quite the interesting invention. I also think that would make, it would just be so nice to kind of like throw your thoughts and feels down into that. I feel like it's just, to me, it's so obvious that that's the magical item that I would want. And I know I talked about it pretty extensively. I think that especially in a chapter called The Pensive, right? There was a,
yeah.
So,
well, we brought a whole philosophy professor to discuss The Pensive.
Yes, and she wanted one too. So she was a philosophy professor and wrote a very good article about it. So go read that article and everybody will understand. But that was my magical item.
Ironically, for as much as I was shitting on Rita Skeeter, my favorite magical item was the Quick Quotes Quill. But I would use mine for benevolent reasons, because basically it's a sort of voice dictation app, if you will.
Yeah.
And you know, I've sort of played one. I would love one of my New Year's resolutions to finally finish one of my books, any of them in my head, whether it's one of the fiction or nonfiction. And I've, you know, toyed with the idea of, I know Google Docs like has a, you know, voice dictation thing, but I've wondered if, you know, if it would be worth me investing in maybe like paying for something like maybe a little more fancy or extensive, because I think if I could just, you know, speak, you know, I feel like I could get a lot more quote unquote written down and be a lot more speedy about it.
Google Docs is really funny when you do that voice to the dictation thing, because like if you cuss, it like bleeps it out, which is really annoying for somebody who is really trying to censor themselves. But
yeah, but alrighty then. Yeah, so then we've got question number 6. What was your favorite spell from this book?
Oh my god. If anybody gives me a bad time about this, just understand where I'm coming from. Not that I want to practice this, but Avda Kedavra, mm-hmm. right? The like
killing curse?
The killing curse. And the why do I like that? Because I'm a total asshole? No. Because it to me it's just like if we're at that level, like that is not something that the wizarding world takes lightly, and it's used in these very like momentous occasions. And I feel like when that curse shows up, it's bad news and something bad has happened and the story will move forward. So, I'm not saying I want to practice it, but it doesn't mean I can't think it's like, it's important. So mm-hmm.
to the plot and to the whole,
and just to everything and structure that world.
Of everything.
Yeah. The power to like, you know, to kill somebody like that. I don't know. I'm not going to make a parallel to like guns or whatever. I'm not going to, but it does definitely change things. It is an agent of change by ending somebody's life.
Yeah.
And also just how that played out for Voldemort and, you know, the web, and it just, it moved a lot along. So.
Okay. My favorite spell was Priori Incantatum, because I am very fascinated just the purely being able to do, again, the Google search history on a wand. I think is a very nifty spell in of itself, which I think is pretty badass. And then in terms of plot structure, I love how it was introduced by showing it as, you know, verifying that quote-unquote Winky used Harry's wand to create the dark mark, and so it's shown in that very small instance, and then that whole thing comes back even more so, and then the added layer of, oh, the wand lore of when two brother wands meet each other, they can do crazy, they can have crazy glitches.
Yeah, that's a good one too. That'd be nice to have if you had a wand to know.
Alrighty, question number 7. What was your favorite magical creature that appeared in this book?
I'm going for something really easy. I love the Nifflers because they're cute. I know they're ornery, but I like cute ornery things. And to me, this one's just really simple. They're cute. They're ornery. My least favorite, I know that wasn't one of our questions, but I'm just going to add it, was the giant spider. So yay, Nifflers, boo, giant spiders.
You even hate the giant spider more so than the blast-ended Scroot?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, like, we've talked many times about how I don't like spiders. So, and that one was, like, nasty. And the blast-ended Scroot, I don't know why that didn't bother me as much. But let's talk about the love. I love the Nifflers. They're so silly and cute. And
They basically are like magpie platypuses that like shiny things.
I like shiny things too. So we have that in common. What about yours?
And then you made me think of Moana. What's the guy's name? Like, who sings the shiny song?
Oh yeah, I know who that actor is. He has glasses like I do. On the crab. His name. He was on Flight of the Conchords. He's in What We Do in the Shadows. Jermaine Clement. I don't remember his name in Moana, but I know who you're.
Yeah,
talking
no,
about.
But I love the he says before his song, "Are you just trying to get me to talk about myself? Because if you are, I will gladly do so in song form."
He's great. I love that actor. He's fantastic.
Oh, I knew it. She just covered a barnacle in bioluminescent algae as a diversion.
That's, I have to watch that movie again. That's, it's a good movie.
Yeah. And so my favorite magical creature was, of course, dragons.
Oh yeah, that's,
yeah, how can it not right. be dragons?
Right. Yes.
Yeah, again, like, there aren't enough dragons in this story, but, you know, the fact that it wasn't just Norbert and then we never saw dragons again, I'm glad they came back in a way that makes sense in the context of this world.
I think it's great. Yeah.
Yep. Question number 8. What is the most gothic element in The Goblet of Fire?
I think chapter 32. I don't know if it's specifically an element, but just the flesh, blood, and bone for all of its, and I said palatable, gothic horror-ness for me. Like, yeah, that's the gothic horror level that I tap out at. And if that was what gothic horror was always like, I would probably read more gothic horror, but usually it tips over.
Rather than the Southern ladies, like, book club guide to slaying vampires.
That was too much for me. It tipped to a place that I did not like. So, like, yeah, I like gothic. Anyway, so there's, I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts and opinions about horror and gothic stuff, but there's a tilt, and a lot of stuff tilts way too dark because it's trying to be controversial and, you know, mm-hmm. there's cannibalism. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not shock value, I know.
Yeah. So yeah, that's mine.
So mine, kind of, again, we deviate in this way that we did with our Gothic Literature podcast of how you like the more horror element and I'm the more like mystery romance gothic element. So what I considered the most gothic element in the book was chapter 1, The Riddle House. The quintessential dilapidated manor who has a really dark, shady past and is the epicenter of rumors and gossip at the local village and all that, and no one knows how they died and, you know, all that stuff, and Frank Bryce, the creepy caretaker.
Yes, that's a good gothic element.
It's, yeah, which, but again, just how our brains diverge, because you need the more horror element because you need the cult with the cauldron and Voldemort rising out.
I mean, that was freaking cool. I don't know. Yeah.
Yep. Alrighty then. Question number 9. What was your absolute favorite quote from The Goblet of Fire?
Well, like I said, I usually go with Dumbledore because Dumbledore is endlessly quotable. But this time I went with Hagrid, and it was page 719 in my version. No good sitting worrying about it. What's coming will come, and we'll meet it when it does. And I said, if I could apply this to my life, I'd probably be a lot happier. So,
yeah. I can appreciate that quote because my parents are of, you know, that's just not their philosophy. They will get anxious and worry about things. And I'm not saying that I have, like, reached nirvana and, like, don't worry about things or am totally zen 100% of the time. But I have gotten to a point that, you know, being anxious over something isn't showing that I care, or that, like, that isn't an innately, like, virtuous quality to show how much I care. Like, you know, I can just deal with it if it goes south, and when it goes south, otherwise there's no point in me, like, tying myself in knots about it. And I've said similar things to my mother, and my mom's just like, I cannot live like that.
Yeah, I'll get there one day. I'm working on it. I've been working on it for years. So, but I thought that was a good philosophy, and I hope to have that level of, you know, whatever in life. So.
Yeah. My favorite was the one that we were talking greatly about last week, not because I agree with it, but that it is quite thought-provoking of fake Moody's, decent people are so easy to manipulate. I kind of put it in the same camp as my favorite quote in book 1, which Quirrell says, not that I agree with it, of, like, there is no good or evil, only power, and those too weak to seek it. Like, again, like, not that I agree with it, but just the commentary of, like, a good chunk of society and people think that way, and what are the implications of that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, just as a Hufflepuff and as a just person, I don't love that, but we talked pretty extensively about it last episode, and how it definitely know people that feel that way. So,
mm-hmm. Yep, but that was mine. And then we've got question number 10. How does this book compare to the others we've read thus far?
If we're talking about...
Without saying darker.
Without saying... Well, that's a challenge for me.
You can say more sinister, insidious, ominous. You can say lots of other... There are lots of other synonyms.
What did I write? I said there was definitely maturity, and it's definitely, you know, aging with, obviously with the characters. So there's some explanation that wasn't present in the other books that we're just kind of told, kind of like supposed to accept rather without, question. There was kind of, and I can't think of a specific example right now, but, I think it's doing a good job of aging with the students, and, you know, throwing things at Ron, Harry, and Hermione that they can handle. Not that they want to, but definitely something that would be a little much in book one. So mm-hmm.
Nice. What I thought about in terms of thinking about book four in relation to the others is certainly the stakes get higher with the exposure of the unforgivable curses and like seeing in the pensive the past of what the implications of not only just using those curses and killing people, but what the implications of the other curse, Cruciatus curse, on Neville's parents, and, you know, seeing the context of that, but also showing, my brain just went totally dead. There was a point I was going to make. What the hell was it?
Definitely
expanding the world. Even though the majority of the time is still at Hogwarts, we're still getting more context and more people of this society. We're getting politicians like Fudge, Crouch, and Bagman to, like, give further context to this society and how Hogwarts at the school, as the school fits into that society. We got a little bit of a detour with the Quidditch World Cup in the summer, which is something like we didn't get at all in the previous books. It was just straight to Hogwarts, or at least straight to the Burrow, like not any sort of, you know, badass field trip. So definitely both in people, in concepts, just very much more expansive of the universe, which is why this book is so thick. Mm-hmm. And Order of the Phoenix will just grow on that in terms of the physicality of all the places they visit. Like this one, like pretty much they're staying at Hogwarts, and it's the different concepts, like the politicians coming into the school, and then in Order of the Phoenix, it'll be the Golden Trio venturing out and, you know, exploring other places and other people.
Oh, that's exciting. Okay, cool.
But yeah, that's how I thought about, you know, reflecting on Goblet of Fire. And then finally, question number 11, what do we think of Harry's narration of this book in relation to the others?
You know, I thought about this, and I think it would have been interesting if he would have, like, interviewed or interspersed some of, like, Ron or Hermione's interpretation of events. And I kind of thought about it, too. Maybe he did that for, like, building notes as research, but... It would have been kind of neat to just see, like, how he...
it would have been nice if he had done, structured it like George R. R. Martin, where it's like, Harry, Ron, Hermione.
Sure. Maybe just, like, for one or, you know, or, like, just kind of a report back. I don't know. Just kind of played with that a little bit. Just, I mean, because it's one kind of perspective. I do think that it was, you know, I think he always takes a fair look at some of his actions and, you know, obviously leaves little breadcrumbs to resolve later. But, you know, I don't know. That's not really a critique. I just thought it would be interesting to kind of integrate another perspective. I mean, we did kind of include he did include the Rita Skeeter articles in there, which was neat. But yeah, it's kind of, I mean, He's doing all right.
Yep. My only thoughts on Harry's narration is that he's, you know, getting much better in writing mystery. Not that he had a say in how things panned out, but he was very good at, you know, putting little crumbs of, like, the subplots and everything, and then the bigger plots as well, plot points as well, like, you know, making sure, like, don't forget this, and just the whole being able to weave the very complex issues of, like, again, Barty Crouch Jr. and all of those things, because, you know, the mystery in Prisoner of Azkaban is pretty darn good in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, the past and, you know, all those sort of elements and crumbs of Lupin being a werewolf and all of that. But book four is even better in terms of, like, tying all those together and just being like, what?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No.
Because, again, like, as you said, like, the whole fake Moody reveal is so traumatizing to people.
It really is. I mean, it was very, it's very upsetting because you're like, I like this guy, but now I don't know who I like and who I don't.
Alrighty then, and thus concludes our wrap-up and our entire coverage of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yes, more than halfway done.
It's more than halfway done, and then that it's just like how long this, like it, I don't know, just how long we've been reading this book. I mean, I just think about the people that, you know, people binge watch shows, people binge read series, and it's just a totally different experience to take it piece by piece.
Yes, it is, again, for me as well, because I've never not binge reread them in such a way like this before. But starting next week, we will begin with Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, my favorite, at least so far, still my favorite in the entire series.
Okay. I'm always excited to read the next one. I'm excited to read this one. You are not the only person I've talked to that said they really like The Order of the Phoenix. So now I'll know why.
All righty then. So stay tuned, everyone, for Order of the Phoenix. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.